Thanks to our sponsor, Malloy Law Offices. They are a personal injury law firm here in the local DC area that helps others recover from car accidents, work injuries, slip and fall injuries, and other types of accidents. They work on what's called a contingency fee basis. So if you hire Malloy Law Offices after an accident, then you never pay anything out of pocket. They also offer educational content and free consultations for those who have more questions than answers, like us at DC by Foot. We're really excited to partner with them next month to learn all about personal liability as a tour guide in Washington, D.C. Visit their website at malloy-law.com or call their offices at 202-335-6141. Malloy Law Offices is open 24/7, so don't hesitate to get the right legal help you need after a personal injury accident.
Everybody, welcome to Tour Guide Tell All. We're your friendly neighborhood tour guides here to share with you the often scandalous and interesting side of history. We are back with another episode for you. It is March. It is spring. It is Women's History Month, and we are very excited to remind you, as always, that women's history is American history. But before we dig more into our women of today's episode, as always, I'm Becca.
I'm Rebecca.
And together we are
the Rebeccas.
And yes, March, Women's History Month, our favorite time of year. Although really, you should be talking about women's history every month of the year. That's my not so controversial opinion there, my not so hot take, because women's history rocks and it's an important part. It's an integral part of the history of this country. If you're newer to the pod, know that every March, we kind of turn a little extra attention to women in American history. So you may want to go back, check out some of the other topics we've covered. In March, we've done quite a range of individual women and events. Today, though, I'm really, really excited because we're going to have a chance to sort of talk about a number of women kind of all at once. Before that, though, thank you to our patrons. We love our patrons. You keep the lights on. You keep it going. Patrons really are the backbone of the podcast. Patrons, you always get a special patron-only episode every month. If you're having trouble with that, shoot us an email at tourguidetellall@gmail.com. And if you're not a patron, you're missing out on a bonus episode every month. So check out our Patreon. There's always a link in the show notes. How are you feeling about today's episode? Are you excited?
I am excited. This is going to be Before we kind of dive in, always like to shout out our friends at A Tour of Her Own, which is DC's women's history tour company. So women's history is American history. American history is women's history. And if you're not talking about women's history as a guide, you're not doing guiding right. Same thing with African-American history, because it's there all the time. And Toho does a really great job of bringing that into the forefront, talking about women and their contributions and women in the public sphere and in the private sphere. And they are really fantastic. So if you are particularly interested in women's history in the nation's capital, give them a check out. They do great tours as well.
Live and virtual, so you don't have to live in the DC area to take advantage of a tour of
our own. They do a lot of virtual content. It's really, really great. So we're today going to talk about the American Revolution.
Woohoo!
Yes, it's good. We win. That's good. We're specifically going to talk about women in the American Revolution. And here's the thing about American Revolution. There's a lot of interesting and cool people generally in American history. It's like this amazingly crowded hour of like interesting, smart, like odd, like the front names like Ben Franklin and George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, they're really interesting. But the second tier people, and even like the third tier that no one's heard of, like Gouverneur Morris is a fascinating, we did a whole patron pod about him.
Amazing.
He's a fascinating guy. So there's just so many like odd, wild, wonderful, intelligent, fascinating people at this moment in American history. Almost too many. It's like an embarrassment of riches, really. And women often get overlooked. And that's kind of true of history generally. But particularly, I think at this moment, like there's just so many men to focus on. You don't have time. And then, you know, women are more in the background. And so they
well, and I feel like I'm going to jump in to interrupt you for a moment, but I feel like too, it's certainly not that women weren't there and at the time that women weren't acknowledged, but I think so much ends up falling on the shoulders of historians and kind of public history. And even just in the immediate era after the revolution, there's this push to solidify the revolution as part of our origin story and write a certain history of it to sort of shore up the political system that we're going to have, one that explicitly leaves women out of the process, right? Just in those years after this event. And so for so long, despite the fact that there's clear evidence that women are integrated into every aspect of this, the focus repeatedly is on the men. And I'll get on my little soapbox personally. As we've mentioned in previous episodes, myself, and I know many of our listeners are members of the Daughters of the American Revolution, which is founded explicitly by a group of women who are kept out of the Sons of the American Revolution, a heritage organization to honor the men that had actually fought in the revolution. And the women, the founders, are appalled at this. And in an op-ed to a Washington newspaper, one of the founders writes, "Were there no mothers of the revolution?" And she explicitly notes that women were there fighting this cause alongside all of these men. And so it's so easy in the kind of matter of just a couple of years or a couple of generations to neglect and purposefully write out those contributions. So it's not something that just happens accidentally either. It's also a choice that's made by people in our political system, by people in our government, by the press, by historians to sort of tell a certain version of our history for so long. And women are there, were always there and played a huge role. So I just have to soapbox it a little bit because it doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Absolutely not. And when the people who are writing your history tend to be more male, they tend to write more male-focused history, I think. And so I think that's part of it. So it's not surprising that women get overlooked, but there are a lot of them. Like, for example, there are so many, first, I think most importantly, there are a lot of unrecorded, unheralded, unknown women who really make this country great, who are the ancestors of people who are still alive today, including yours truly, who just work on the farm and raise the children and care for the elderly relatives and do their bit, make this country persevere. There are women who, like Betsy Ross, we talk a little bit about, who really I think what she should be more famous for is that she raised kids and managed to keep a family together and keep a business during what could not have been an easy time. And I feel like there's a lot more where that came from that we'll have just gotten lost. There's also a lot of the great men of this country's founding were great. But part of the reason they were able to be great, I think, is that they had women in their lives doing a lot of the work. Right? So you could go to Philadelphia for months at a time, because in those days, you don't travel for a weekend, right? You travel for months. It's an endeavor. So you're away from home. You're away from your source of support and financial, whatever, however you make money. And so someone is at home doing that. And the third thing is that the enslaved help a lot.
Yeah.
It's easy to run the country when someone else is taking care of all of your needs, whether it's the women in your life or the enslaved that literally do not have a choice.
If someone else is producing a majority of your income, you are free to pursue leisure, which is what those in the political system are essentially doing. For many of them, the pay is non-existent or very minimal. So, yeah. You know, it's leisure work to be sitting around and writing founding documents and serving in the early Continental Congresses. But if you aren't personally responsible for your income and revenue stream, someone else is, well, then you have a lot of free time on your hands.
Right. I mean, think about just our lives today. How much we could sit around and think great thoughts if we didn't have to worry about having a job, making dinner, going to the grocery store, making sure our clothes are clean. This is why so many of our founding fathers are enslavers. Because if you're, and I'm going to pick on Thomas Jefferson because he's like a top level name, but if you have someone at home whose job it literally is to make your clothes, make your food, clean up your food, and clean your house and do all of those things, you have a lot of free time. And I could think great thoughts too if I didn't have to worry about cooking dinner tonight, you know? So that's I think part of my point. And I feel like you can see this very clearly in the two best known women of that era. Martha Washington, by the time of the American Revolution, she doesn't have young kids. Like, her and George Washington don't have any children together. So the children that she only has one at this point. And he is a parent himself. So he's a married man. He's an adult. He makes questionable choices, but that's a whole different story. So she doesn't have kids at home and can therefore be free to be with George Washington whenever he needs her, right? To go to Philadelphia, to go to Valley Forge, to go to New York. Like, she has that ability. She also has, they both have people at Mount Vernon, both enslaved and free, to run the show. They have an overseer. They direct where they're going to plan, what they're going to plan, who's going to do it. And all of those things are sort of like, Washington has a hand in it, but he doesn't have to do a day-to-day bit. He doesn't have to be there. He doesn't have to be involved in like the regular management of this. And neither does Martha. This gives them a lot of freedom and financial security. And you can't really underscore how important that is enough to be able to go and do things for the country, to be present at Valley Forge, to not only him, but also her. The other person is Abigail Adams. And the Adams's financial situation is different. They don't have slaves. She's raising young kids for at least a little part of this. And so she is at home running the family farm. Work for Congress in those days is not well paying. And even if it is paying you, it's not really paying you often. Congress is continually running short on its bills and not able to make its payments. And so John Adams is not making a lot of money doing his government service. He's away for long periods of time. And Abigail is the one at home in Massachusetts who raises the kids, keeps the farm, cares for the elderly relatives, keeps his books, keeps them financially solvent. And that's the work that they both acknowledge, I think, allows him to pursue a government career, to be the great man. And so that's an important key to a lot of this.
Well, yeah. And there's a reason she spends less time at his side than Martha gets to spend with George. And that's not to negate, certainly Martha Washington makes important contributions. Sure. She's an important advisor to her husband as well. We know a lot more about Abigail's role because we have letters from Abigail and John, and you see a lot of Abigail's intelligence and foresight, her famous sort of remark to remember the ladies. Martha, after George Washington's death, as we mentioned in previous pods, destroys almost all, essentially all of their correspondence. And so a lot of what we have in regards to Martha's contributions comes secondhand and from secondary letters and sources. But there's a huge difference in their economic situations and a huge difference in how they're choosing to sort of pursue life. And it allows Martha this freedom to spend over the 16 years that George Washington is away from Mount Vernon, essentially 8 years for a revolution and 8 years as president. Martha can spend a lot of time with him during that. Abigail, on the other hand, it's a much bigger sacrifice, the times that she does spend away from the farm, and their family can't bear it. And so often she has to advise and support her husband from abroad, from a distance.
And I also think part of the reason, because they're apart so much, were more letters. Like, you're not writing letters to somebody who's with you all the time, right? So there are more letters to have with John and Abigail. And so the person that there's a couple of people I want to talk about. The one I want to really drill down on a little bit is Ben Franklin's wife. So our company gives tours in Philadelphia too, and they're really great. And I did them for a while. And at one point I was with a group of school kids and we were at Christ Church, which is the big, beautiful old church in Old City where all the founders worshiped and some of them are buried. And it's this lovely thing. And there was this docent who's talking to my school group and he was trying to make this point about women and their role. And he asked the kids what Ben Franklin's wife's name was. And with perfect timing, one of one of the boys raised his hand and said, Mrs. Franklin.
I mean,
and it, like, you could not have illustrated his point better. Just, we don't even know, like, in your popular imagination, everyone knows who Ben Franklin is. He's on our money. But how many people out of 100 could name his wife? I would bet like 3. It really is. It's such a sad commentary on her. And she's extremely important to him, which makes her important to American history. Part of the reason I think this is that he's our oldest founding father. right? Franklin's the oldest signer of the Declaration and the oldest signer of the Constitution. So obviously his wife is older. Ben Franklin's a full generation older than George Washington. He is well into his 80s when they're debating the Constitution. So his wife is obviously about his age. Her name is Deborah Reed. We don't know a lot about her early life, but we know that she, as a teenager, meets and falls in love with a teenage Ben Franklin, and they want to get married. He calls her Debbie, which I think is cute. They have this romance, but at this time, Franklin's a teenager. He's not Ben Franklin yet. He doesn't have a source of income. He's going to travel abroad for a while. And her mother's like, no, 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 no. He doesn't have really good prospects. We don't really think this guy's going anywhere. And when he goes to London, her mother refuses to allow them to get engaged. They like promise to each other, but he goes off to London. And as everyone who goes to London does, Franklin falls in love with London and wants to stay there. And so he writes this Dear Debbie letter, like, so sorry, we're breaking up, it's over. And she marries somebody else. His name is John Rogers. He proves to be a bad choice. And after only months, he runs off. It is not clear whether he dies or not. There are rumors that he does, but also rumors that he doesn't. But because a death cannot be proven, when Ben Franklin returns to Philadelphia and their romance re-sparks, she is not legally free to marry him.
She's not a widow by law, and divorce is essentially non-existent. And without him there to either be dead or to break it off, it illustrates something we've talked about in many episodes, which is sort of these weird legal ways in which women are limited in their right to act, right? And so she's put in such a tough situation. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I always such admire about her, is because I think some women would have felt, all right, I have to just, because this is where I'm stuck, I will just remain single, essentially. And she's like, nah, stop. I'm good. I don't want to be alone.
No, she doesn't. I don't want to be alone. No, she's like 18 or 19. She's like, no, I don't like that. So her and Ben Franklin decide that they're going to get married without getting married. And so they basically get common law married. They have a ceremony. They announce they're going to live as husband and wife. Like, they do everything but the legal piece that they cannot do. They have children together. She even helps to raise. So Franklin comes back with an illegitimate son named William. To this day, we really don't know who William's mother was. Where his birth happens, we don't know. But she, like, uncomplainingly raises her husband's illegitimate son, which is a lot. That's a whole thing. And one of the things about the reason we don't know about as much about Deborah Reed is because as Franklin gets wealthier and wealthier, like, it becomes pretty clear pretty quickly, he's special. He's Ben Franklin. He becomes our first millionaire. He's an entrepreneur and a inventor, and he's a bunch of things. And it's kind of clear that as they get older, they diverge in terms of their personality. I think she thought she was going to have one kind of life with him and ended up with another. And it seems like she doesn't feel like she fits into this new version of Ben Franklin, this millionaire version, this sophisticated version. She was not well educated, does not feel that she is the equal to her very quickly famous and important husband. And so she takes more of a background role as he rises in prominence. She raises the kids. She does the home thing. She manages all of his businesses when he sails and goes abroad. He goes to England for a while. And he says, you should come with me. And she's like, no, I'm okay. I'm good. I don't want to go. And at some point he comes back, tries to get her to come over with him. It seems like at this point, it's more of a, like, he asks knowing that she'll say no. And she does indeed. He starts to get letters, his second trip to London, where she's increasingly in ill health. She's less and less communicative. She's ill. And even though he is very aware of her illness, he does not change his plans. Franklin does not come back to Philadelphia, even though his diplomatic assignment is over and he could very easily have come back. Basically, she stops writing him letters and dies about a year later. It's not clear if she had a stroke or was incapacitated in some way, but he has ample time and leisure to sail across the ocean to be with his wife in her last days, and does not. And I have to say, I think that's very poor of Ben Franklin. This woman has raised your children, including one that isn't hers, managed your businesses, and done all the things. She proves actually a fairly adept businesswoman. And really, he is indebted to her in so many ways. And he does not bother to sail across the ocean to be with her as she is ill and dying. And I think that's kind of poor, I think.
It's not great. It's not a great reflection of character there. I feel for Deborah. I think she's so interesting. I wish we knew more. I wish we had more of her letters and more documentation. I think absolutely what you said and what I think other historians have sort of agreed on is this idea of when she meets him, like, he's obviously going to be a man with some success, but she's thinking maybe the biggest printer in Philadelphia, not an international superstar, which is sort of what he is. He becomes this man whose words are known around the world. And it's intimidating. And it is, I think, for somebody who had a very modest background and very little education, it would have been intimidating. And I wish we knew more about her interior life. I wish we knew more about what it was like when she was alone for so long in that time running these businesses. And I think what we do know is through the reflection of her success with his businesses, but the willingness he has to sort of just compartmentalize and just say, well, if she's ill and there's nothing I can do, why change my situation now is a little disheartening. But it also provides, I think, some important context. I mean, she dies 1774. This is a couple of years before the Ben of our popular imagination. I think most Americans, when you think of Ben Franklin, you're starting in 1776. You're thinking about the older guy in Congress who's quippy and full of little bon mots and gouty in the leg and is sort of the sage advising these young upstarts on this revolution. But it's colored, I think, a little bit by the fact that he has made some choices and done some things that are a little suspect in terms of character.
Yeah. And he also, like, Ben Franklin wants to go to the UK to live permanently. And that's what he thinks he's doing. Like, he considers himself British and it is a shock to him. And one of the things that really propels him towards the American Revolution is the idea that the British don't consider him British. And that really angers him. At the time of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, he's really the only American who's known worldwide. Maybe George Washington is known for his military exploits, but George Washington's not the kind of famous that he will later be. Franklin, at this point, is a scientist. He's a discoverer. He's an inventor. He's like a bunch of different things. He's also a millionaire well before his 50th birthday, which is insane. And so he's like a big deal. And I think increasingly she feels either that she can't compete or that she just is not interested in his world, but sort of takes a back seat to let his eminence do its thing. And I don't think she wanted to go to Britain. I don't think she had any interest in like being British. I think she was American before he was in some ways.
No.
Another person to talk about who's really interesting and doesn't get enough credit is Mercy Otis Warren. So the Warren family is Boston based. Her husband, Joseph, there's a bunch of Warrens. Her brother is a very prominent. She is a pamphleteer, a revolutionary. She writes plays. She's a historian. She's extremely well-read. And she's friends with Abigail Adams, like besties with Abigail Adams. Her and her husband are this like fiery Revolutionary War duo. They like rally support, fundraise, gather troops together. She's going to correspond with so many of the important men of her day. Like she writes to George Washington, is like, hey, dude, what's up? She advises important guys like Samuel Adams and John Hancock, both of whom are going to play a prominent role, not only in Massachusetts, but in the 13 colonies, all colonial politics. She advises them on what's coming and what's going on. She has salons in her home, and she's really incredibly smart. She spends a lot of the revolutionary period writing, galvanizing support, the whole thing. And Alexander Hamilton himself says that in her case, the female genius outstripped the male, which coming from Hamilton is quite the compliment. Yeah. Another is Mary Catherine Goddard. So fun fact, the second person to print the Declaration of Independence was a woman.
Yeah.
What? I know. Mary Catherine Goddard was from Baltimore and she was a printer, not her husband, but her. She printed under her own name. So the Declaration of Independence We all think of it as nice and cozy now, but the truth is when it was printed, if you got caught printing it or signing it, you were in some trouble by the British, man. And so the first person to print it, it's a very famous printing run days after it's agreed to. It's called the Dunlop printing. Some of them still exist. Dunlop doesn't put his name on all of them because, you know.
Just in case.
Just in case. Mary Catherine Goddard does. She puts her name on, it's called a broadside, which is kind of like a newspaper, but basically she does the second printing run about a month after they accept the language. Hers is also going to be the first with signatures. So like, not obviously the original signatures, but she's going to print out who has signed this document. So all of the men who have at this point, John Hancock, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, da da da. She prints at the bottom all of their names that they have put their names to this document. So not only is she putting her name, she's putting their names so that they are all inextricably tied in with this document. And so this is going to be because considerable risk. It would have been very easy for her to just print the dude's names on it and leave her own name off so that she wasn't going to be charged with treason, but she doesn't.
And I should mention, I mean, part of the reason a Baltimore printer does the second printing is they have fled Philadelphia. Yeah. We sort of forget, I think, a little bit of how this war rolls. And they, you know, write the declaration, they vote and agree on the language, but the war is raging on and the Continental Army is moving pretty rapidly and the British Army is moving pretty rapidly. Ooh. And they get the heck out of Dodge. They leave Philadelphia, yeah, because the fighting is getting closer and closer. And so that's why they head a little further south to Baltimore. So that's how it ends up in the hands of Mary Catherine Goddard, is because they're worried. And so the risk is very real because we've not won anything yet, really. We've not had really any major military success in this war. That will come a little bit later with the crossing of the Delaware and the taking of Trenton. But for her to do this, I mean, they're on the run a bit and she's still willing to put her name on it. So I think that's really important context. This is not like, hey, we've had this declaration out for a month and it's going great for us. Like, can you do another printing? It's hey, we're running away and we need more copies of this.
Right. It's a really kind of a big deal. She is possibly, likely the very first US government's female employee. We don't know. I mean, obviously that's a hard thing to kind of figure out, but she was employed by the federal government, possibly our very first female employee in the federal government, and she remains postmaster general in Baltimore for 15 years. She basically runs the show in Baltimore. She is very prominent. She makes, and postmaster general in those days, that's how you communicated, right? It's not just printing, it's also letters and newspapers and broadsides and the whole thing. Like, she's the one that handles it. She is married, but her husband is erratic. And so she's like the one that gets it done. So Mary Catherine Goddard is cool.
Yeah. A few little additional things I'll say is she had taken over the Maryland Journal, the paper that she publishes, from her brother, who was basically a vagabond. He had gotten this business by virtue of being the man of the family and just runs it into the ground. He's always into trouble. He's in and out of debtor's prison, in and out of all kind of personal troubles as well. And eventually when he disappears, she just takes it over and she runs it. She takes his name off the masthead, puts her own. And she had been from the beginning very passionate about the cause of this revolution. She was truly a patriot. She believed, I think, understandably, if you think about what life was like for women, that she had no benefit being a British subject. She definitely had at least a chance at opportunity in a new country here, right? Where she could just sort of take over her brother's paper and carve out this life. So from the beginning, the Maryland Journal is one of the most like far loudest patriotic papers in the country at the time. I mean, she was out there editorializing about British brutality and cruelty. She reprints Common Sense. She's one of the first printers to reprint Thomas Kean's Common Sense. And she was always putting out extra editions about Congress and about the war and really trying to drum up support. So even before the Declaration falls or kind of comes its way and falls into Baltimore for her to have the opportunity, she had been really on the forefront. So I'm not at all surprised that she was willing to risk treason, to risk arrest, because she really believed deeply in this cause. This wasn't something I think anyone had to convince her to do. And in addition to being postmaster in Baltimore, which was a huge, huge deal, she will run this paper for 25 years and be kind of a leading voice in Baltimore politics and in the politics of Maryland at the time. So she's really just an incredible, incredible woman. I think a figure who should be better known, certainly in our region, for all that she did, in addition to producing this particular important broadside version of the Declaration of Independence.
Phyllis Wheatley. Phyllis Wheatley is a poet, but not just a poet. Phyllis Wheatley was enslaved. She was born in West Africa, possibly present-day Gambia or Senegal. She is sold to a trader who then takes her to Boston. And the reason she's called Phyllis is because that's the name of the vessel that she was transported on, which is a really terrible and heartbreaking detail. I would hate that. She becomes Phyllis Wheatley. The Wheatley part is the family that purchases her, enslaves her. A merchant, wealthy merchant and a tailor, John Wheatley and his wife Susanna, they are the ones that name her after the ship that transports her. And she is going to be taught to read and write in English, which is extremely rare for the time. There were, in several places, laws against teaching enslaved reading and writing. And so the fact that her enslavers not only do not mind, but encourage her, both of the children in the house actually are going to tutor her in reading and writing. And her enslavers, it must be said, are known as progressives. She has very unusual education and really almost an unusual education for a woman of any race at that time.
That's exactly it. I mean, it's absolutely, I think, very, very rare that you would have the situation for any person enslaved. But I think for any woman, regardless of background, to have the education she had in this era is pretty boggling, because not only does she get sort of this one-on-one tutoring, she's getting to learn to read and write, but beyond that, she learns Greek, she learns Latin, she studies in-depth literature and philosophy and poetry. And these are things that just would have been, for the rarest of the rare, your most wealthy, educated women might have dabbled if they had the aptitude and interest, but it's so out of the norm of what was typically allowed for any woman, and certainly for any enslaved individual. So the Wheatleys are fascinating to me for this aspect. They're a part of this institution, and yet it seems to be that they have this understanding that certainly Phyllis has an aptitude and can have an aptitude, and they nurture it. So they're very unusual for the time. This would be very much a one-off sort of situation.
Yeah, and think about how, like, I mean, she learns to read and write in Greek and Latin. And think about, it's one thing to speak English as your native language and learn to write Greek and Latin, but English is not her native language. She had to learn English and be conversant enough and fluent enough in English to then be taught another couple of languages on top of that. So that's incredible. She goes to London with the son of her enslavers, Nathaniel Wheatley. She meets the Lord Mayor. She does a whole thing. And then she comes back and publishes a book. She writes poetry. So she publishes a book of poetry, and she becomes the first African-American author of a published book, we think. She is manumitted, her enslavers manumit her after her book is published, and she gets married and they have a couple kids that die young. And then she has chronic asthma and she develops pneumonia and dies pretty young. But Phyllis Wheatley is really fascinating. She is going to correspond with all kinds of interesting people. She writes a poem, like dedicates it to George Washington. She apparently goes to visit him at his headquarters in Cambridge. And so she's recognized even in her day for her aptitude and her excellence and sort of being outside the norm.
Yeah, I mean, her work, and we'll put maybe a link in the show notes to a couple of poems in her work. It's really just impressive. It's beautiful. We have a few little Phyllis Wheatley connections here in DC. There's a couple buildings and things named for her. She's recognized at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. There's a little statue of her. So there's some places here in DC where her legacy sort of lives on. But her writing is really incredible. It's just impressive. It's really, really impressive. And more so when you understand the background of her life and sort of how she gets to have this opportunity and to be essentially this teenage poetress who is meeting the movers and shakers of the day. It's just amazing.
Yes, it's really something. And another woman no one's ever heard of. Everyone has heard of the Boston Tea Party, which in fact had its 250th anniversary in December 2023, that is. There is another tea party that is less well known. It's called the Edenton Tea Party. It takes place in North Carolina and is led by a woman named Penelope Barker. Penelope Barker is a local woman, relatively wealthy, planter class. She's known for her sympathies to the Patriot movement. So she is an American patriot. And 10 months after the famous Boston Tea Party, she organizes a tea party in Edenton, followed by over 50 other women. They create a tea party and they meet at the house to protest the British Tea Act. She is the first recorded women's political demonstration in colonial America, which is something else, really. So it's a political demonstration. It gets forgotten now, but at the time it was lauded. In the colonies, it's a big deal. It gets treated with interest, a little more of a spectacle than perhaps a real protest, but it's published. She sends these fiery letters over to London, and in London, these women are going to be mocked. There's a lot of misogyny. There are cartoons that portray them as bad mothers with loose morals. And that is not how the men in Boston are being portrayed. Like, the members of the Boston Tea Party are treated as criminals, but not as loose women. Like, there's a real misogynist tinge to how these women are going to be portrayed in the results of this. So it's unfortunate that their protest is not seen on the same level as the sort of more prominent men who protest in Boston. And Penelope Barker continues to protest. She is going to spearhead. They swear off tea. They have ball gowns made from homespun fabric to boycott British goods as best that they are able. And so there is a lot. She leads a lot of this local protest in the South. And at the time, particularly before the revolution really gets going, a lot of this protest is happening in Boston, led by people like Mercy Otis Warren. It's not as prevalent in the South. And people like Penelope Barker are going to really push for this to be sort of a nationwide, the entire colony to get involved in the political protest.
Yeah, I think in somewhat more recent years, the Edenton Tea Party has gotten some attention. We're approaching, as you listeners may know, America's 250th birthday. So we're coming up to bicentennial plus 50, which is very exciting. And there's been some attempt, I know, in North Carolina to really put some markers up, more markers and plaques and new signage to really help educate people of this event and the role that women played in this, which is very interesting and exciting. So I think this is something that hopefully we're going to be hearing and learning a little bit more about.
Yes. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think that in a topic or episode like this, we should note too the role that women played on the battlefield. It's very easy to imagine that the role that women play is mother or wife sending their beloved male family members or spouses off to fight and then tending to home and hearth. And I'm not diminishing that role. That role is significant. Mm-hmm. And a lot of women would fall into that role. And they're the ones who run the businesses and run the farms and tend to the families and have to deal with the heartbreaking reality of this war, whether it's the death of their loved one or someone returning, having lost limbs, having the emotional and mental impact of this war. I'm not diminishing that at all. But in addition to being the support system for what we think of as the men who fight the American Revolution, there were plenty of women who had no hesitation about going out onto the battlefield, whether those were the women who tended in the winter camps, when we think about the encampments like Valley Forge, because back then in the winter, you're like, we're just done fighting for a couple months. There's no point for any of us to do it. You dig in. So you just have to wait out the winter. And that's not something that they're doing in these male-only spaces. They have wives, they have women coming to make meals and tend to injuries and wounded and deal with producing the socks and the clothes and the things that they need to fight this war. But you also had women certainly defending their own property, women taking up arms to defend their farms and their lands and their homes, and women who wanted to fight. And I think the most famous example I'll throw out here of women sort of fighting in the American Revolution is Deborah Sampson. She essentially disguises herself as a man in Massachusetts, and she is going to just give a fake name. Robert Shurtleff is the name she uses. It's the name of her deceased brother. This is pretty savvy because if anyone thought to look at any record, they'd find a Robert Shurtleff. He's a real person. He just is deceased by the time the American Revolution begins. And so she joins the 4th Massachusetts Regiment. She's mustered in 1782. She's going to fight in New York, and she finds it fairly easy early on to disguise her gender, the reality of her background. It's pretty easy to pass yourself off. If you dress the right way and act the right way, and in the midst of war, who cares, right? You're just on the battlefield, focused at the task at hand. It's not until she needs medical care that she's going to have a little bit of trouble. She gets shot and she realizes that they're going to want to, you know, right, take a little look under her clothes and get that bullet out. And she basically escapes from a field hospital and takes the bullet out herself using a penknife, which is pretty crazy. And then she just gets a sewing needle and sews up her wound. Now, she knew there was another bullet in there and it was too deep and she couldn't get it out herself. And she thought, oh, well, I'll just leave it in. And that's what she did. And she never really recovered from that. Her leg was never the same. So she has a real serious war wound. She pretty much is able to keep this secret until she gets scarlet fever. She basically contracts a really terrible fever, very likely scarlet fever, which she does survive. But she's so terribly ill that she has to really be taken in by a physician in Philadelphia, who at this point is so impressed and awed by her dedication to the patriotic cause that he agrees to keep her secret and does not tell anybody that this soldier he had treated for several weeks was actually a woman. She is going to get an honorable discharge. Like the other veterans of the Continental Army, she receives a pension after much petitioning, as these soldiers had to often do to get paid. But she will be paid for the service that she rendered her nation. She does eventually marry. She has 3 children. And later in life, she will travel around to make money and actually give lectures and talks about her service. And there's backlash to an extent. There's always somebody. And she would write about people coming to these talks and men sort of haranguing her after. But there is, for the most part, kind of an embrace after the war of her service. She's really held up as what makes this new country so special, that anyone, women, anyone of any, were willing to take up arms and fight. And so she sort of becomes a bit of this folk hero. And I love Deborah Sampson. She was somebody who, as a kid, I was really fascinated by. And I think she's a figure we should know more about. We should talk more about. Again, willing to really go on the battlefield and put her life on the line, and then never shied away from saying, I deserve my pension and I deserve to be recognized for my military service. So, but there are many other women who rendered aid on the battlefield, but I think Deborah Sampson is the coolest.
Yeah, Deborah Sampson is really badass. There's another woman, Elizabeth Bergen. She basically is in New York, which is a loyalist stronghold, and she gets herself the ability to go on British prison ships where they're holding Americans prisoner, and will bring aid and comfort and letters and bandages to Americans who have been taken in British custody, eventually helping them to smuggle information out and eventually helping them to escape. She helps hundreds of men either get information out or get themselves out. And after the war, she basically writes a letter and says, hey, look it, I may not have fought, like picked up a gun, but I also did fight. I assisted the army in a very material way. I deserve a pension like a soldier. And so she writes this letter to the government, and no less a person than George Washington writes a letter in support of her. Like, yeah, totally did. Totally deserve money. Totally deserve a pension. Thank you. And she gets one, which is pretty cool. And so there's a lot of really great women that do not get, for a lot of reasons, a lot of interest and a lot of support and a lot of recognition for their, what they did during the American Revolution. And I think there is a lot of room for people to talk more about the home front on the war. It's not a topic that gets as much discussed.
Absolutely. And I'll do a little shout out again to the Daughters of the American Revolution, the DAR. If you're listening, I'm sure you have a DAR chapter or organization near you, but this is a big push of what the DAR has done from the beginning, but really has tried to do in the contemporary era, is try to make sure as many of these women that we can name and recognize, make sure they are named and recognized, and to really try to gather as much information as we can about the role of women in this time period, because it's essential. We would not have the country we have. We would not have won this revolution. We would not have set out to form this new nation without those women. And they were there at every step of the way.
Correct. And so thanks for coming along with us. We talked about some women's history. We're going to be back with more women's history in March. And yeah, we've got a great rest of the spring and into the summer. We're setting up our schedule. So if there's something that you want to hear about, we're here for you. Let us know. And you can find us on all the socials, Tour Guide Tell All. You can email us and we love to hear from you. We've had a lot of great visitors on our tours. So please come on our tours if you're going to be in DC. And thanks for supporting the pod and our sort of historian pod journey.
Thank you guys so much. We'll see you next time. Happy Women's History Month.
Happy Women's History Month.